Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Magazine. It's Friday, October 28th, 2022. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. I'm your host, Jack Armstrong. Coming up on today's program, we'll hear about Proposition 122 on this year's ballot, which aims to decriminalize psychedelic substances. Then we're hearing about a new inclusive dance studio that recently opened up in Boulder. After that, it's sports talk. At 8:30, it's the BBC. Then Connections comes your way. This morning, host Duncan Campbell will be joined by guest Lisa Graves to discuss the endurance of democracy in America. At 9:30, the Morning Sound Alternative will be hosted by Greg Schultz to bring you 2.5 hours of eclectic music until noon. That's all still ahead, but first these local and regional headlines with KGN News' Stacey Johnson.
Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold and Attorney General Phil Weiser join leaders from other states to file amicus briefs with the United States Supreme Court Wednesday. The briefs come in response to an upcoming court case filed by North Carolina Republicans that will go before the U.S. Supreme Court in coming months and argues that state legislatures should set the rules for elections without intervention or judicial review from state constitutions, state courts, or other state officials. Weiser joined a coalition of 22 attorney generals, while Griswold, along with 12 other secretary of states, argued that the theory or judicial argument would dismantle long-held checks and balances on state legislative action by state courts that have historically regulated elections. According to a press release from Weiser's office, the theory is gaining traction among conservative academics and jurists, and if the Supreme Court were to rule in favor of North Carolina's Republicans, state legislatures would have the authority to decide election policies and district maps without oversight from state courts, which the Attorney General says would wreak havoc on long-held and established election practices. Denver's Regional Transportation District said Wednesday that light rail service between the Florida and 13th Avenue stations in Aurora would not resume earlier than December. Service for the R Line segment halted after a light rail train, speeding into a curve, derailed last month at South Sable Boulevard and East Exposition Avenue. The derailment caused the two-car train to split, with three people going to the hospital and overhead damage to poles and electrical lines for the route. The Denver Post reports the transportation agency and Aurora police are still investigating the incident and noted another train derailed at the same location in 2019, which resulted in recommendations for override technology estimated between $12 and $15 million. The agency also said beginning Sunday it will no longer provide shuttle buses between the two stations to connect services for passengers going north and south. RTD cited low usage of the shuttles and the ongoing bus driver shortage as reasons to discontinue the shuttle connection. According to the Denver Post, RTD has brushed off repeated questions from the newspaper as to when the agency will complete repairs and reopen full operations of the R line. Today is National Vote Early Day, and RTD is waiving all bus and train fees so Coloradans can drop off their ballots. The transportation district
is 21 through 64 with no or limited health care. According to the American Cancer Society, only 37% of uninsured women are up to date on cancer screenings. We know that finding cancer early on can make a huge difference in treatment and outcome. Making sure we all get caught up on mammograms will save lives. Emily Kinsella, the Women's Wellness Connection Manager for the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, said to the Denver Gazette. For KGNU, I'm Kiara DeMari.
A 216-unit affordable housing apartment complex in Denver opened this week. The Reserves at Green Valley Ranch community offers affordable housing for low and moderate income residents and celebrated its grand opening Thursday. The Denver Department of Housing Stability said in a press release that the city provided around $2.1 million in financing for the project, which was developed by Overland Property Group. According to a press release, Mission Rock Residential will operate the complex and reserve 144 units for households making between 30% to 80% of the area median income, or $63,000 for a single-person household. Students with CU Boulder's Save the Bees campaign will canvass Boulder's neighborhoods Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m. by handing out pollinator-friendly wildflower balls, while also highlighting the importance of bees and their vital habitats. According to campaign organizers, late fall and early winter are the best times to plant wildflower seeds. The group says the handout event is their form of reverse trick-or-treating by naming the event Trick-or-Seeding. Today's weather includes sunny skies with a high of 60 for Denver and the upper 50s for Boulder and Fort Collins. Winds could gust as high as 16 miles per hour today. Tonight will be mostly clear with light and variable winds and evening temperatures in the upper 20s, low 30s. This morning, most areas will have a hard freeze until 9 a.m. The current temperature in Boulder is 32 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Jack Armstrong. Coloradans will vote on the decriminalization of the use, possession, and growth of natural medicines commonly known as magic mushrooms in the upcoming November ballot. KGNU's Claire Purnell spoke with Markeen Harluck, senior Colorado correspondent at Kaiser Health News, to get the backstory on Proposition 122.
Proposition 122 is named Access to Natural Psychedelic Substances, but it's focused more on the decriminalization of psychedelic substances instead of legalization. So what's the difference, and how will decriminalization allow for more access?
Sure. There's sort of two parts to this. One is the decriminalization. So that basically means, you know, if the police pull you over and they find you've got magic mushrooms in your car or something like that, they can't arrest you for that. They can't prosecute for it. The decriminalization would allow people to grow magic mushrooms, to possess magic mushrooms, to use magic mushrooms. It wouldn't allow them to sell magic mushrooms other than through a specific pathway that the state would set up for the treatment of various mental health conditions through what's known as psilocybin-assisted therapy, in which, you know, you go to a therapist, consume the drug there on the spot. And this is not intended to sort of encourage recreational use. It's really intended to create a pathway for people with mental health conditions to be able to get treatment using these plant-based compounds under the supervision of a therapist.
Colorado was the first state to legalize marijuana. We are now the second state to possibly allow the use of certain psychedelics. Do you expect the path to legalization, if it is passed, of these psychedelics will follow and mirror the path of cannabis throughout the United States?
I don't think you'll see the corner psilocybin shops like we see, you know, obviously with marijuana here in Colorado. It won't be that kind of, you know, free and open access. But what it could do is provide some treatments for mental health conditions, which right now we just don't have really great answers for.
I read your KHN article that you wrote with Matt Voles, where you talk a lot about this ballot initiative and what it could do potentially for mental health.
Yeah, so the clinical trials are done under really, really strict protocols. So we're just trying to test out, one, the safety of these drugs under this kind of treatment protocol, and two, whether it seems to have some effect. And the initial studies have been, I mean, really compelling. It's small numbers, obviously, but the kinds of response rates that they're getting are just something we don't see with many pharmaceutical drugs. So, you know, a good treatment for depression right now, maybe 40 to 50% of people would react to that treatment. And it's a drug that you would have to take every day, probably for the rest of your life for it to continue to have an effect. With psilocybin, we see these treatment effects after only one administration. So people come in, they have their session, they go through their therapy, and they report significant progress in symptoms of depression, symptoms of anxiety, symptoms of PTSD. So it's really quite compelling, you know, and these effects last for months, 3, 6, 9 months out. Patients are still reporting improvement in their symptoms. There's also really good evidence on for substance abuse, things like smoking cessation, alcoholics, even some opiate-type drugs. Psilocybin just seems to sort of reset these patients' brains, and they're able to break out of these negative patterns that they have been in, whether that's for depression or anxiety or substance use. Now, the caveat here is that these are, have been really small studies. So we need to do these studies in a much larger group of people. And sometimes when you do it in a larger group of people, the rarer side effects come out and you realize, okay, well, this might not be a solution for these people. But I do expect that it could get FDA approval and could be, you know, the new way that we treat these very tough to treat mental health issues.
It does seem very interesting that you could, you know, try it one time and experience benefits for 6-9 months. That also makes sense why it would be more accessible, because you pay for refills, you pay, and it's just ongoing and ongoing until either you never stop or one day you have to learn kind of how to live without it. In these clinical trials, who would you say is the perfect candidate?
Clinical trials have been trying to find solutions for people who don't have solutions elsewhere. So they're looking at people with hard to treat depression, people who have gone from one antidepressant to another and nothing seems to work for them. Can psilocybin be the answer for that?
Those in opposition to this measure worry that there's not enough research to legitimize the legalization of psychedelic mushrooms and plants for medical and recreational use. Why should or shouldn't we wait for more research to come out before we vote on this measure?
So the researchers are the ones who are really saying, let's do this the right way. Let's make sure we've done the research to show that this is safe and this is effective in these types of people, so that this treatment can come and help the masses. You do have a lot of people who are concerned that, you know, we opened a certain door with marijuana legalization. And while there haven't been widespread negative ramifications, there have been some problems with that. And I think there are a lot of advocates that are saying, hey, let's not rush into this and create a situation where we don't know what the outcomes will be. So it'll be really fascinating to watch. And in Colorado, you know, if this passes, they would start with psilocybin, but by 2026, they could add things like mescaline, ibogaine, DMT. So it could potentially open up an entire new range of treatments and treatment protocols that we haven't seen for people that really need a lot of help.
Markian Harluck is a senior Colorado correspondent at Kaiser Health News. He's been reporting on Proposition 122, a ballot measure asking voters to decriminalize psychedelic substances, including psilocybin, on this year's ballot. Markian, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks, Claire. I really appreciate you having me on.
For KGNU, I'm Claire Purnell.
A new inclusive dance studio, Mi Chant Li, recently opened up in Boulder. Rosanna Longo-Better spoke with the creators of this eclectic dance sanctuary on their mission to provide artistic expression to diverse participants.
Proposition 122 is named Access to
Please start us off by telling listeners about Mi Chant Li, since it's a relatively new space.
Sure. My name is Mario Olvera. I am a co-owner of Mi Chant Li. I'm also the art director. I've begun doing art lessons out of Mi Chant Li. I'd like to start off by saying art and movement is our focus at Mi Chant Li. We would like to make it an art and movement sanctuary and try to bring as much of the core elements of hip-hop into our space and offer that to our youth and to our community.
Why is hip-hop such an important expression for our communities of color?
I can respond to that by saying, you know, hip-hop is a global language. You can find hip-hop anywhere in the world. And people have this tool, this medium to express, to connect, and to heal. It has been a healing tool for many decades now. So we just like to continue that healing that it had once brought to the community and just bring that essence back of healing.
Mi Chant Li is also hosting A Día de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead celebration, this coming weekend. What are the plans for the event?
Hi, my name is Changa Hernandez. And yeah, this Saturday, we're going to do Baile de Calaca, the Skeleton Ball, which is going to be an event of all kinds of art. We're going to have a bunch of like hip hop dancers. We're going to have Danza Azteca dancers also getting down, a live DJ. And importantly, we're also going to have a bunch of art that was donated by people that go to the space and by just a bunch of artist friends that we have. And we're going to like throw like an auction to, you know, raise money for the studio and just to like give a platform to like, you know, dancers and artists to like show off, you know, their skills. And to really, you know, so that we can all, like, be artists together. And, yes, it's happening on October 29th from 6 p.m. to midnight, actually. It's going to be a long event. I mean, the first 6 to 8 is going to be more like a showcase with, like, you know, dancers and, you know, band and music. And then after that, it's just going to be like a party vibe where we're just all dancing, having a good time and, you know, buying art.
It's going to be a lot of fun. But I also have in studios Julio Amida. How is it that you were able to come up with this idea of offering the space with programming?
I am the programming director at Michantli. Basically, all of our programming, it's either involved with dance art, visual art, or spoken word or written art, right? So we teach... Each of the owners here is a teacher as well as at the studio. I teach breakdancing, Changa teaches poetry, and Mario teaches art or urban calligraphy. But it's not only us who are the teachers, right? We have other teachers from different ethnicities. We have teachers from Vietnam. We have teachers like from Denver, teachers from Boulder, and we're very rooted with our Colorado teachers and giving them an opportunity to teach their crafts and their skills in a place like Boulder, who doesn't really have that type of diversity always in its communities. And it doesn't always have that type of representations in teachers for little Latino kids to see that they can also be dance teachers, or little kids from Vietnam seeing that they can write graffiti or write poetry with teachers that aren't always necessarily straight from here, right? Like, all three of us have roots in Mexico. We have roots in Texas. We have roots basically all over, right? But for us to show that to the next generation of youth is super important, and to create a more diverse world in Boulder is super important to us as well.
Please mention to us about your students that are going to be performing in a very high level competition.
Yeah, so besides just being the programming director, I am also the head breaking coach at Michantli. I teach a group called Unit 22, who are a bunch of talented young individuals ranging from the age of 9 all the way to 17. And all of them are training to be in the either in the Youth Olympics or in the actual Olympics in 2024 in Paris. And they train really, really hard, and they have really big dreams and really big goals. And my job, which I love, is to help them reach these goals. And already this year, two of our students at Michantli were able to reach the national stage and ending in the top 20 spots in the country. But yes, that's also my other side job at the studio.
But I have a question for you, Mario Olvera, and it is about this concept of the Day of the Death. Originally is a Mexican or Mesoamerican holiday, which has since been adopted by other Latin American communities, including those based in the United States. How do different communities celebrate Día de los Muertos? And is there any particular way that is marked here, especially in Colorado, that you know?
Yes, I understand that in this time, lots of different families and cultures and from different backgrounds honor and celebrate their ancestors in their way, in their form, in their forma. And I've come to understand that this holiday that we know of as Día de los Muertos comes from such a rich culture and tradition, deep-rooted in the ancient times of Mexica, in Aztec times, where honoring ancestors was more than just 2 days, that it was actually two veintenas, which means 220-day months. And so it was 40 days of honoring ancestors, and beginning with small ceremonies, bringing light food and then a little bit of flowers. And every ceremonia that we do would grow and grow and grow. And at the end of those 40 days, then we'd have the big celebration of what we now know of Mikailhuitl, which is just that time, the time of honoring ancestors, celebration.
Roots. How important are our roots? Who are the local artists that are going to be offering their art? And where can people find out more about this event?
I'm just blown away by the amount of support and contributions given by all of our family and friends, all artists' friends that have just shown so much love, donating art pieces, showing up to create art with us. It's just been a phenomenal movement all in all. We have a beautiful artist name, some by the name, some that don't want to be even recognized because they're so humble, right?
And
we have a beautiful artist, a good friend of mine, Bryce Whittem, is actually one of the artists that I grew up just being so inspired. He used to do the chalkboards at the Mountain Sun and the Southern Sun, and he's a beautiful muralist. He's going through a lot of transition, and I'm so grateful and happy that he was able to actually complete a piece for us, and with so much love and gratitude, you know. We also have David Ocelot Garcia wrapping up a piece for us right now. He's actually one of the muralists down in Denver. He actually painted the mural underneath the pavilion at the Raza Park. And mm-hmm. So if you've seen that pavilion, you've seen his work. He's a big name in the music and the art scene, and he's right now working on a beautiful, beautiful bridge for the community in Denver. So I'm really grateful that they have contributed to this auction. And, you know, these big names are so awesome to have on our walls, but I just want to say the big energy that comes from this art movement is just the community involvement and the engagement, and all of our young artists that contributed, our young dancers who were like, what are y'all doing in here? Just drawing and coloring, and can I do it with y'all? I thought that was just so beautiful, and it was just the invitation that we always want to have when we go into this space, right? To be invited to be creators, to be invited to express yourself, and we want to just have that always available and accessible. So I give so much thanks to all the artists that contributed thus far, and still more to come.
Yes, more to come. My guests today have been Mario Olvera, Changa Hernandez, and Julio Amida from Michantli Dance Studio. Thank you for coming by the studio today. For KGNU, I am Rosana Longo-Better.
And now, it's Sports Talk with KGNU's Jimmy Searfoss.
Wake up in the morning feeling like P. Diddy. Grab your glasses. I'm out the door listening to KGNU's Sports Talk with Jimmy on Friday mornings. Hello and welcome back to the very best of the best when it comes to sports shows here on KGNU. That's right, you are listening to Sports Talk with Jimmy. I am your host, Jimmy Searfoss, coming at you with the hottest news and stories from across the Front Range. And today we're going to hop into a time machine way back before I was even born, before I existed. That's right, guys, I'm talking about the 1990s. So bust out those flannels. Because in Colorado, here in the Centennial State in the 1990s, it was baseball crazy. The Colorado Rockies had just established this as their home, and a certain baseball team was formed, the Colorado Silver Bullets, in 1994. They were an all-women's baseball team made up of the top women's talent available. They were led by none other than Phil Negro, who managed the team. He's a Hall of Famer who spent 24 years playing MLB baseball across multiple teams. The goal of the Silver Bullets was to compete with men's teams of any level. They would play college teams, semi-pro teams, amateur teams, just about anybody. They were all the brainchild of Bob Hope, who had been trying to field a women's professional baseball team since 1984. He finally managed to get some sponsorships, mainly from Coors, the beer company, who's able to fund the team known as the Silver Bullets. Their inaugural season started on Mother's Day in 1994, and they would go on to play until 1997. They would travel across Colorado to play games, and even way outside of Colorado. In 1996, they played a series of games in the cities across Taiwan. These women played tough. They famously got into a brawl, an all-out fight with another team. They were playing the America's Travelers, an amateur baseball team, and the pitcher hit batter Kim Bratz-Voisard. The pitcher then smirked and laughed at what he had done, which prompted the batter to start the fight. One Silver Bullet player said they wouldn't have laughed if they were men, and they didn't want to use the excuse of being women to not do something about it. And apparently, this fight got pretty wild. Mark Lastinger, a reporter from the Albany Herald, reported that she was on him like a cat on a pork chop. Phil Negro said it was as good a brawl as he'd ever seen in his 24 years of professional baseball. These women were tough, and they were a great inspiration for women in baseball today. They established a base in Georgia in 1995, and they would play games there as well. They even had their first winning season in 1997, where they went 23-22. Unfortunately, though, that would be their last, after sponsorships cut ties and they weren't able to find enough money to continue. The legacy lasts, though. The Colorado Silver Bullets now have a spot in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and they left an impression on girls across baseball everywhere. And that is all the time I have for you today on this cold Friday morning. Make sure you tune in next week to see what I have in store for you guys. You guys have been listening to Sports Talk with Jimmy. I am your host, Jimmy Searfoss. We'll see you next week.
And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Jack Armstrong. Special thanks to Stacey Johnson, Christian Garibay, Alexis Kenyon, Kiara Damare, Rosanna Longo-Better, Claire Purnell, and Jimmy Searfoss for their help with today's program. Stay tuned for Connections.
Support comes from Brock Media's Boulder Magazine. The fall issue features local people, events, culture, and tips for happiness. More information at getboulder.com.
This program is supported by you, the KGNU listener member, and by the Boulder Chamber. The Boulder Chamber strives to build community through business and help their member businesses and organizations grow while advocating for an economy that sustains Boulder for those who live and work here. More information at boulderchamber.com.
Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Talk your talk.
Walk your talk.
KGNU Talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30 on KGNU.
And welcome to the program. We've got an excellent program today. We're 11 days out from the election. And I'm here with my great friend and colleague, Lisa Graves, to update on all things legal and political regarding this midterm election, which is actually, for real, the most important election of any of our lifetimes. And I can speak as someone that's been saying that way back since 1968. And before, we were blessed, for instance, with the election in 1960 of Jack Kennedy, and then the early part of the LBJ presidency with his war on poverty and the Great Society vision, bringing in Medicare, Medicaid, and a number of social programs that were really majoritarian, what I call democracy 2.0. Democracy 1.0 is where we are right now. We've lapsed back into it, which is an oligarchic plutocracy where money not only talks, but it talks very loudly and governs all of our politics. And we're seeing that unfold now in an extreme way to match the extremism of the billionaire persons and corporations' desires through their chosen operative arm called the Republican Party. And so what we want to do today is stress what is actually happening as we lead into this particular election. And particularly, we want to call into information that you don't get on the major media. The major media is trapped in this recurring trope that somehow elections are always like the blue horse and the red horse coming around the home stretch, and it's going to be close. It's going to be close. No, the red's ahead. No, the blue's ahead. No, the red's ahead. In our